Ibrahim Al-Marashi is an associate professor of history at Cal State San Marcos, focusing on modern Iraq. He holds a glistening array of degrees from UCLA, Georgetown, and Oxford, and was even once plagiarized by the British government. If you're interested, Google the dodgy dossier. He's lived in Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Egypt, and Morocco, among other places, though we actually met in Prague. We sat down earlier this year to discuss the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, magic, time, and academia. With love, affection, and my very best wishes, this is Scott Newman, and you're listening to 27 Rouge.
Ibrahim, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming on to the show. I'm very excited about this discussion.
Likewise.
And just so our audience knows how I met you, or how the two of us met, I was at a conference in Prague this past summer, co-sponsored by the Fund for American Studies and the Media Project, I believe, right?
Correct.
And it was, what exactly were we looking at? It was more or less focused on, well, maybe you could describe what the conference was about. I feel like we encompassed a lot of, we hit a lot of themes: religion, the war in Ukraine, reporting on conflict.
Exactly.
How would you summarize the conference?
Well, overall, it's supposed to be a journalism boot camp, not necessarily for journalists, anyone interested in the field of communication, and in my particular case, interfaith dialogue. And so it was you had a very interesting experiment in that I improvised. I was supposed to be giving lectures on kind of the role of media and faith, media and religion. But I the very first day of class, I felt let me ditch the formal lecture and tell the students assembled my background. And it just so happened one of the students was very much related to my family history that I gave that day. So it's this program does have a schedule, but sometimes the spontaneity of the instructors can lead to some interesting outcomes.
Well, I'm certainly glad that the spontaneity of you led to the outcome that it did, which ultimately led to our having this conversation and brings us to the subject, or one of the subjects of this discussion, the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War. First of all, what was it? Why were we there? What was the Iraq War, Ibrahim? I know what it is. I know some of our listeners know what it is, but people get confused. You know, there were the Gulf Wars in the 90s, mm-hmm. then there was the Iraq War. We're obviously talking about the second one. Why don't you just give us a little bit of context here?
Well, it's the second Iraq war for the U.S. It's the third war in total for the Iraqis. And if we just kind of, and they're all related. More or less, we start in the year 1979, Saddam Hussein becomes president of Iraq. The next year, he invades Iran. Then there's unfinished business from that war. So the Iran-Iraq war was 8 years. It's the longest conventional war of the 20th century. As a result, Iraq doesn't gain much, but you have a massive segment of Iraq's population that was mobilized, close to 1 million men under arms. They were hard to demobilize. And then about 2 years later, Iraq owed a massive debt to its neighbor Kuwait. It had a problem reintegrating this militarized element of Iraqi society. So it engages in a second war and invades Kuwait in 1990. And what ensues is, in the short term, it did eliminate Saddam Hussein's debt. But what he miscalculated was the American response, that America would mobilize and eject Iraq from Kuwait. Now, that war led to some unfinished business. And the unfinished business, let's say we could go from the Iraqi perspective, the war never really ended in 1991 because Iraq was then endured UN-imposed sanctions to give up weapons of mass destruction. Now, those weapons of mass destruction from the U.S. perspective were still, in their mistaken view, still present in Iraq up into the eve of 2003, and ostensibly. The war of 2003 was to remove those weapons of mass destruction.
Nominal.
That's a simple explanation, but it gets a lot more complicated once we go into the nuances and details of what was the war really about? That's something we debate to this very day, 20 years later.
What are some theories?
Okay, so it depends. Let's say the 1991 Gulf War. You could look at it this way. That was a war waged by George H.W. Bush. And as one of the regrets made by not only the president at the time, but those around him, was that somehow, despite all expectation and despite the odds, Saddam Hussein survived. And not only survived, allegedly planned the assassination of Bush during a trip to Kuwait a few years after the 1991 Gulf War. So if we look at it on the personal level, GW's Bush legacy to finish what his father didn't? We could look at it that way. The second, is it just a reaction to 9/11? In other words, after 9/11, not only did the U.S. strike out against Afghanistan, but that seemed so easy. Was there now like a window of opportunity? Let's finish the business in Iraq. A good number of the administrators in the George W. Bush administration had also served under his father. So there we could say it's a window of opportunity. 9/11 enabled a chance to eliminate the world of this dictator. Theory number three, it's Iraq had the second largest proven reserves of oil that was just sitting there. I mean, very few barrels per day were trickling out. We're talking about millions of barrels under a UN oil for food program. But that was the great prize in the Middle East, all this untapped oil. So was it a war over the future energy security?
Why was the oil on tap that they're sitting on a fucking gold mine?
Because of those sanctions I mentioned earlier. So no energy company could process and sell Iraq's oil because that would be a violation of the UN sanctions. The idea was Iraq had to give up its weapons of mass destruction. And before it could do that, once that was done, then it could start selling its oil. So basically, as long as the sanctions were there, most Iraqis were starving and that oil just sat underneath the soil.
And they also probably didn't like being Saddam Hussein, didn't like having the UN breathing down his neck, telling him what to do.
So Saddam, more than anything, wanted the lifting of the sanctions. And this is one of the great the failure to read Iraq around that time was this. Saddam was so desperate to get the sanctions lifted that, in fact, the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, for the most part, had been eliminated, sometimes by the mid-1990s. That's how desperate he was for the sanctions to be lifted. The problem was, and this was also to some extent Saddam's fault, he wanted some opacity about this issue, particularly for his neighbor Iran. He really wanted Iran to believe that there was some residual chemical weapons capacity in Iraq to keep the Iranian state from not taking advantage of Iraq's weakness.
Yeah. The geopolitics is fascinating. I don't pretend to be any kind of expert. I studied history, not Middle Eastern history. The last really in-depth the last deep dive I did into Middle Eastern history was as a teenager. I did this program called Seeds of Peace, where they bring together Israeli, Palestinian, Egyptian, Jordanian, and American kids. And we sit around in like dialogue huts and talk about.
Well, that's what TFAS used to had that program. TFAS used to arrange a similar program, which I took part in. Where, and I'm not sure how old you guys were. You said teenagers, so this was the university level and above. But that was what TFAS has the same kind of idea, is to bring together these, the youth.
It was a good idea, Did it work? I don't know what that means. I don't know what kind of metric one could use, but the idea was that you're taking these Israeli and Palestinian teenagers and you're sticking them in the same room, and you have these really heated, I mean,
I'll understand. Use the rubric. When we did it, it was the year 2001, and year was brutal, tense year between Israelis and Palestinians. I'll tell you, did it work? I made an Israeli friend. You know, it depends what rubric. I mean, do you change an individual's life? It did change my life. Did it solve the problem in the region? Never. But I think it depends on how you define success. I made an Israeli friend that I wouldn't have normally made otherwise were it not for this program. For me, that was success.
I think that's the idea, that they're nominally the name Seeds of Peace. They're planting seeds. Because afterwards, Ibrahim, after the dialogue sessions, which lasted half a day, we would go and play, you know, soccer and volleyball and frisbee together, and we would take our meals together, and you know, there was a lake. Obviously boys and girls were segregated for swimming activities. Mm-hmm. But we would do like normal teenager shit. Mm-hmm. And it did in some ways for some people, I think, personify others to whom they wouldn't otherwise have access. A lot of dynamics at play there. But anyway,
so our program was on.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No.
Program was in Greece, and for our version, it was the ocean, the sea.
Yeah.
And we would go to the sea, not segregated, and then instead of volleyball, it was going to the nightclubs afterwards. Yeah. But the same kind of dynamic. When you're a bit older, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we unfortunately, I don't know, there was not much alcohol involved for us, but similar kind of thing. I think for us, the thing is that we were younger, we were kids, Yeah, I must have been, I was 17. The following summer, I had a scholarship through, it was the high school version of CLS, the Critical Language Scholarship, called NISLY-Y, National Security Language Initiative for Youth, to go and learn Arabic in Jordan. So I lived in Amman for, 6 weeks, something like that.
Oh, good for you.
That was interesting. But anyway, the point of all of this is I don't pretend to be any kind of expert on Middle Eastern history, Middle Eastern geopolitics, and in this case, Iraqi history or Iraqi geopolitics. I've taken some courses, of course. I've read a fair bit about this subject. Not that much, a little bit, I guess, maybe more than the average person. I don't know. But again, I don't know how much the average person reads about the history of Iraq. Actually, you know, in our program, there was an Iraqi participant. We no need to
correct.
To name who it is for their own privacy.
That's right.
That's interesting. PFAS really attracted an eclectic and international.
And I was really happy because it's been a long time since. I mean, for somebody, for myself from the diaspora, to teach somebody still in Iraq, for me was a great emotional experience. For me, Iraq was a place that I studied from afar, outside, and that somehow in this process, the knowledge I acquired could be used to impart, you know, new insights to an Iraqi. I never could have imagined that being a possibility. Well, I mean, to be honest, I mean, growing up, I never also could have imagined that Saddam would have ever left Iraq. So it's just funny the way, you know, life turns out.
You grew up in Baghdad.
No. Actually, my connection, it's quite complicated. My father is from Zanzibar.
Okay.
And his dad would have come from, his dad would have been basically what we would say an ethnic Persian who happened to live in the Ottoman Empire, the parts that are our Iraq today. And when the British kind of invaded after World War I, my grandfather basically didn't see himself as an Iraqi. That notion didn't exist. He saw himself from somebody who came from a town called Najaf. He saw himself as a Muslim, very connected to Najaf, and he saw it under occupation. And so he became an insurgent. And remember, we're talking about 1920s. An insurgency emerged in Iraq when it was occupied. And it's amazing because in 2003, the same thing happened, but the US and the UK were completely caught off guard. When history told us that this had already happened once in the 20th century already. So my grandfather had to escape Iraq after, you know, being hunted down, and he ended up going to this island called Zanzibar, which also happened to be part of the British Empire. But by that time, he was tired of fighting the empire, so to speak. He wasn't like a Star Wars rebel. He gave up fighting the empire. And so my father is born in Zanzibar. His first language would have been Swahili, English, and then he picks up Arabic much later in life. Actually, Arabic and Farsi, he picks up later in life. So he was more African in culture in terms of his outlook. My mom comes from Baghdad, but I was born in the U.S., raised in California most of my life.
Interesting. No, it's fascinating. Fascinating.
And growing up in California, Iraq was also a place we feared because by this time, yeah, we're talking about Saddam's Iraq when I'm growing up.
A place that you feared or that Mr.
We all feared, my entire family. We all feared it because we knew that even in California, there were elements in the Iraqi diaspora and the community that were spying on behalf of the government in Iraq.
Yeah.
Spying on our every action.
They're everywhere.
Trying to kind of shake down us, you know, basically take money so that we would subsidize the Iran-Iraq war. They were asking us for donations, so on and so forth. We would get letters in our mailbox saying, why are you organizing an Arab cultural festival when you should be raising money to support the Iraqi war effort?
What would the consequences of non-compliance, what might they look like?
Oh, well, any family we had in Iraq would suffer. And we don't even want to imagine that. So it could be anything from getting a visit from the secret police, which you would never want, them losing positions, and depending on activity. I mean, this is why if you were engaged in any oppositional activity, political activity abroad, yeah, if you had family in Iraq, they would definitely suffer.
It's like the panopticon. I think it was Bentham came up with the idea of the panopticon.
Yes, Jeremy Bentham, the panopticon. That's a very good analogy. Absolutely.
You're always just being watched.
Well, remember that the panopticon was Jeremy Bentham's kind of utilitarian design for the perfect prison. And the perfect, most efficient prison.
That's the operative word here. You're living in fucking sunny San Diego or wherever in California, you know.
Exactly.
And at the end of Western civilization, having ice cream, but, you know, not sure who's maybe listening.
Yeah, who's watching you when you're being watched. And the idea of the panopticon, yes, was this tower in the center of the prison where kind of the prisoners didn't know if the guard was there or not because the observation chamber was obscured. And that's a very good metaphor, you know, invoking the panopticon. Absolutely. That was the nature of surveillance in the diaspora. You were never sure which elements of the Iraqi state were there. You can't imagine then what was life in Iraq like in that regard.
Yeah, sure. I did research. Again, not a subject in which I claim to be an expert, but I did research into Serbian paramilitary organization in the 90s. During the disintegration of Yugoslavia.
The Tigers?
Yeah. Yeah, Arkin.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
There's a great book, actually. I just read it by Christopher Stewart called Hunting the Tiger, which is...
Interesting.
It's a biography of Zelezka Rasinova, Arkin. That's another... And the Serbian state security apparatus was an entangled web, to put it lightly.
Actually, that's I did a comparison of both intelligence services.
Really?
So if you what you studied in the kind of the intelligence apparatus of the former Yugoslavia that became the former Yugoslavia, and if you notice similarities, it wasn't entirely accidental, and often they cooperated with each other. So there is a reason.
Why would Iraqi security services or state security be cooperating with Serbia? What business do they have together?
Well, so remember, Yugoslavia was part of the non-aligned movement. You know, it's technically a socialist communist state, but also kept its distance from the Soviet Union. And that was basically the foreign policy of Iraq. Iraq's infrastructure, you have to understand, its dams, any kind of massive infrastructure was often built with Yugoslav aid. And then
really?
The other way around. A lot of Iraqis got scholarships to study in Yugoslavia.
I didn't know this.
There's a strong connections between both countries.
I had no idea.
I was in Serbia. I was in Belgrade in December, and you don't know how many people I met who had spent time in Baghdad in Iraq.
I was in Novi Sad in whenever I was there. I don't remember. August maybe. Such an interesting place. There's an expression that I've adopted into my own vocabulary now, where when something is, I'll say this is Serbia, meaning something akin to what Jake Giddey's heard at the end of the movie Chinatown, when he's told, "Forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown." There is such what to somebody who grew up in New York or Connecticut or Pittsburgh or anywhere or France or grew up in Nantes or Normandy, whatever. You couldn't begin to explain some of these things. Why did Yugoslavia disintegrate? I don't pretend to understand. I have a very cursory understanding or elementary understanding. Was there genocide? Okay, if there was genocide, why did it happen? What happened? You know, how could people do this? You can't begin to explain some of these things without a lot of buts, and maybe it's such an entangled web. It's impossible to explain anyway. So when something is difficult to explain, or when something is so out of the realm of, you know, you see this a lot. I do this. I don't pretend that I'm like, I'm not trying to draw a comparison between the two, but I'll just give you an example from my own life. I'm somewhat of a digital nomad. Like, I travel around all the time. I was in 41 cities last year, which was too much, but you know, I move around all the time. I'm like a shark. I go from place to place, mostly alone. And you just know how to do certain things. I live out of a small carry-on suitcase. And you clock a lot of things. You know where to go and not to go, like when something smells off, whatnot. And there's all these programs now where they're trying to digital nomad collectives, basically. Where these people want to like quit their 9-to-5s and like experience the digital nomad lifestyle, right? And for some of them, like, these programs are great because they have structure and they like find you your apartments and they do all of this stuff. But I was trying to explain how someone asked me, like, how do you live this lifestyle? How do you do this? And I was trying to explain things and they're like, oh, but you know, I have all these clothes and my belongings and my furniture and all of this. And I just couldn't, they're like, someone asked me like, where am I going to store my hair dryer? And I need to bring a printer with me. And no one said I need to bring a printer with me, but just for the sake of example. And I was just kind of like, you're just so far off base. Like, that's not how it works when you're living on the road. This is exactly. Not that I'm in a war zone, but like, when something is so complicated, when something is Chinatown, sometimes it's better to just say like, "Khalas," like, I can't explain this to you. Like, go see it for yourself. Like, Westerners or people who are not from Serbia, I think, will never understand why what happened in Serbia and Croatia and Montenegro and Bosnia. You don't understand a little bit of what I'm getting at? Like, it's so...
Yeah.
We couldn't begin to understand it, you know, without having been there, being Serbian, understanding this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand sort of what I'm grasping towards here?
Yeah, of course. Let me tell you about in my experience in Serbia, having the connection to Iraq allowed me to bond with so many Serbs, because of course Iraq and Serbia have something in common. They've both kind of endured a bombing campaign for weeks on end and had to endure it. Both countries got bombed by the U.S. Now, Iraq is a unique case.
NATO bombed Serbia, not the U.S.
NATO, technically NATO, but that's you're absolutely right. But it's interesting how the Serbs remember it. what's interesting is this. So Iraq had gone to war with the U.S. twice. Only Germany in recent history has had that honor, right? So I don't know if it's an honor, right? So, you know, you have these countries that are born out of conflict with the U.S. It's still part of the psyche. And, you know, when you go to Serbia, when you go to Belgrade, you still see the buildings that haven't been... haven't been repaired. In some cases, sometimes they're left destroyed on purpose. So the shadow of the war is always there. And you can never you live your life, but it is part of who you are. It's part of your identity. And so that's it, whether it's Belgrade or Baghdad, it's part of the fabric, you know. Now, It's interesting because you mentioned being a digital nomad, and let me just say, as a pre-digital nomad myself, I've been to 55 countries. I've lived in Yemen in the 1990s, which was the most wonderful experience of my life, out of, again, practically a carry-on suitcase. And so one thing about the nomadic life is you're absolutely right. I miss those days. Now where I've accumulated so much stuff, it's even hard to imagine, can I just pick up and go like I used to do in my pre-digital nomadic days? But I think it also says a lot, you know, how attached to our stuff we are here. Whereas people in Iraq and Serbia, a good number of them had no choice. They had to leave all their stuff behind.
That's either an excellent point.
Destroyed, or it was a matter of survival that they leave it behind, and they just they are nomads. This is what the difference between, I guess, a nomad and a refugee is. One is about choice. One is coerced, compelled to leave.
I'm sorry. Could you? What's the difference
between I think a nomad and a refugee is
yes,
the latter.
One is elective, and one is coerced.
The other is and compelled. And I think it's a really good point, because when we think about refugees, how many people actually want to leave home? It's always a hard, there's always has to be a push factor.
Yeah.
And that's as a historian, what I'm fascinated by is studying that push factor in all of this.
I totally agree. I mean, this is such a difficult subject to which I don't have answers. But, you know, immigration policy, people don't fucking want to leave. Like, if it were nice where they were, they wouldn't be leaving.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, you know.
I think it's important to remember. I mean, then you get to the question of solutions and do we have the infrastructure to take people in? It depends what country you're in. Whole number of myriad factors. Are the kids actually, are they being trafficked? Who belongs? Are they with their parents? You know, it's a lot of complications. But at the core, I think important to not forget, as you know, people don't fucking want to leave unless circumstances are kind of shitty.
Exactly.
I am not a refugee. I am, I guess, homeless by some definition. But obviously,
you're free by some definition. Another definition, you're free.
I am free. There's just a universe of difference between the experience of me and some kid from Honduras trying to come into the U.S. or someone leaving Syria or wherever else. But it's fascinating. It's not fascinating. It's important to remember these are people who have had to just grab their shit and go in a way that was probably, you know, they wouldn't have selected for if there were viable alternatives.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's funny when we're mentioning migration, I have this book on my shelf. It's called The Beekeeper, Rescuing the Stolen Women of Iraq. And the interesting thing about a book like this is basically it talks about ISIS conquering large parts of Iraq and taking away from their homes sexual slaves, women who maintained bee orchards or beehives were kind of forcibly taken away from their homes. So there's also this element we also have to realize that even in the 21st century, then there's the other element where people are literally forcibly displaced. There's coerced and compelled refugees, but this was some other category. These were captives, war spoils in their eyes. Remember how the Jews were uprooted from Jerusalem to Babylon? That was an ancient Assyrian practice, for example, or Babylonian practice. We've also witnessed that in the 21st century.
I'm just taking
Angelina Jolie actually has a program protecting, maintaining bee. You know, she's an honorary envoy on behalf of UN, the UN High Commissioner on Refugees. But she has a special program for people who for maintaining beehives in a global context. And you see, the importance about beekeeping for me is that Iraq is it doesn't have a lot of water, and I didn't know how important water was, regular rainfall was for
what bees. What do bees have to do with water?
So apparently that's it. If you don't have access to water, a lot of the women who came back to Iraq and again maintained the beehives, well, I guess think of how much water is in honey. You know, that's the importance. It's all a cycle. The honey comes from flowers that have to be irrigated.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the climate fluctuations that are hitting Iraq. It's you see now kind of a delicate cycle that has played, the supply of water, protecting women in Iraq from the depredations of ISIS, refugees. This is where we are 20 years later. Talking about bees.
Yeah, no.
And unfortunately, sexual slavery.
Yeah, I feel that there's some kind of metaphor in that, yeah, everything is connected, you know, down to bees, individual insects coming to humans and sexual slavery and honey and water. And it's a whole, as you said, delicate ecosystem. Everything's connected.
Exactly.
And speaking of connection, you are connected to the Iraq war, not by being, by virtue of being Iraqi, but also in relation to a paper you wrote, which somebody decided to plagiarize. And then use a site as justification for invasion, or what was this plagiarism business?
So it's very interesting. Let's go back to our conversation about making friends with Israelis.
Okay.
So let me talk about what happened with my friend. We kept in touch. And it was in 2001 we met, a year later. He operated an online journal on Middle East studies.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, my PhD thesis at Oxford was on the Iraqi security services.
Right.
And so he asked, would you want to take part of your thesis and publish with us? So basically, I gave him chapter 2, which was an explanation of how the Iraqi security services functioned. Remember this kind of the complicated, convoluted networks that you were talking about in Yugoslavia. It was the same in Iraq. And this, my chapter that became an article, kind of explained how the components worked. And back in 2002, nobody was looking at this information, never mind being on the internet. So that when I published that article, and, you know, I'm doing it as a favor for a friend. I saved it to the last minute. I rushed it and sent it off. And sure enough, by the beginning of 2003, just a few months later, The news breaks that what was my article that was published online, somehow good chunks of it had made it into a British intelligence dossier that had just been given to the British Parliament. And the British Parliament had just voted to go to war against Iraq based on this document that they don't know is plagiarized from my material. Now,
not appropriately used. They totally misappropriated this for... They misunderstood it. They botched it.
Plagiarism, yes, it's a nice way of putting it. So what I'm writing about is primarily about the 1991 Gulf War.
Right.
Historical
documents. So their stuff is completely out of date.
So they're taking it, using it to justify an impending invasion of a place where I have family, right? Not only that, you see, it's not just plagiarism then. They took some words and made them, just the changing a few couple of words made all the difference. Basically, they were saying more or less Iraq was supporting Al-Qaeda, which I would have never written, which just was not true. They added a few words like that to make it, make a connection between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. Mm. And then, of course, padded it with a couple of pages at the end to make the argument for war. So it was just kind of this melange of plagiarized material that was then manipulated to justify the invasion of Iraq. And in the rush to do that, they copied a misplaced comma in my original article. And that's what gave away the plagiarism.
Mm. Mm.
Beyond a doubt, you could show my original article with a misplaced comma in September 2002 and connect it to that dossier that Colin Powell took in front of the United Nations and presented as evidence for a Security Council resolution calling for military action against Iraq. That's how far I traveled from my Oxford dorm room to the United Nations General Assembly.
Well, among other poor foreign policy decisions, I think... Colin Powell might have benefited from grammar lessons and having known about this misplaced comma.
Or Turnitin would have solved the problem for them, or ChatGPT would have solved the problem for them.
ChatGPT might have solved
the
problem.
Write it.
But two things. One, ChatGPT can't distinguish between factual and counterfactual information seemingly in the same way that the British intelligence can't. And second of all, I've had my set of issues with Turnitin. I'm a writer. I like writing. I don't plagiarize. But Turnitin would find like just similarities with dumb shit like citations. You know, and then I would get like 10%, like, because I had a lot of citations. And I was like, bro, this is clearly scheisse. But, you know, the professor or graduate student or whoever goes in and sees what it is. I don't know. Actually, you know, in college, I don't think we used Turnitin. We used Turnitin in high school. I think a couple of professors wanted to turn it in, but most did not give a fuck. It's not that they didn't give a fuck. They gave a fuck. They graded my papers, some with more care than others. Not everyone with the care that Ibrahim grades his papers, which I'm sure is the utmost care. But I don't think Turnitin featured heavily in college. I mean, I can't remember. It might have, but I don't think that it did.
It depends. I tell all my students the lessons of this, what I've endured because of plagiarism. And I would think they would not plagiarize after I tell them such a story. Sure enough, some students do. It's not so much that it depends. So for this reason, I do use Turnitin. I have
also,
to
if you have Turnitin, why would you plagiarize? You know you're going to get caught.
This, I'm telling you how some, I hate to say it, there are some really clueless students out there who still will just go ahead and plagiarize at
the
end of the
day. That's like, you see the cop, And you're like, let me have a swig.
Exactly.
Let me have a swig right before he's going to pull me over.
But just like in the real world, there are idiots who will see the cop and still will, you know, take a swing at them. And sure enough, that's, I think, the way with some students. So what I have to do now is just get very super creative and create assignments where it's almost impossible for them to plagiarize.
What about ChatGPT? Hmm? Wait, sorry, hold on. No. We're not going to video to ChatGPT yet. What do you mean video essays? That's interesting. That's a novel thing in education. You have them talk about it?
Oh, it's very easy. I mean, with Zoom, just set up your own meeting and I want to see them tell me. So like as somebody who teaches history, I make them do this assignment where basically it's this. Tell me how history made you the person you are today. What happened in your family's past?
You can't plagiarize that.
Exactly. You can't. And then more or less I have them recorded in front of a camera for me and tell me in your own words, tell me you've internalized the history that made you who you are. That's the way you get around it.
And then they can, you know, have a better understanding of their family history and all that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, as a professor, you don't want a student to leave your class and forget the material you've taught them. No person leaves a class forgetting their own history. That's the whole ethos of my history courses, is to make them realize history is all around you. It's not the past. It's history is the study of time. It's how the past affects your present and will affect you going into the future. And I mean, that's my teaching philosophy, is, you know, make them see the world around them in a different way after having taken a course with me.
This is an interesting subject. The question of how time is studied, approached, experienced, felt, all the things. I feel that in America, people are we have a close relationship with time. There's an expression, you know, in English, in American English, time is money. There's a lot of like...
I change it around. I say money is time. We don't realize money is time. Time is not money. Money is time. Think about that when you invert it.
What is money? What does that mean?
Money is time. Think about this. I mean, whatever we pay for, what are we paying for? The time it took to make that and how somebody values their time or how a company values its time in making a Tesla or a Honda or any product.
We
pay for somebody's time. So in other words, it's the other way around.
Yeah. If a cocktail costs $15 and you get paid $15 an hour, you're paying 1 hour of your time to enjoy said tasty cocktail. But Ibrahim, I wanna go deep on this just not deep. We'll talk about it for a couple of minutes. I think there's a difference between like the American sense of time and experience of time, and maybe the Arab sense and experience of time. And obviously, America is a huge country. Arabia is encompasses an enormous geographic area. But one thing I've felt, not just even Arab, but in other parts of the world, one thing I felt is that in America, people are they're very focused on productivity and on like optimization,
efficiency, you know?
Waking up early and I don't know, guys get up at 4 a.m. drink raw eggs, like it's sort of baked into the cake. There's obviously lazy people, but I mean,
sure.
The way we experience time, I think, is the way we treat time is as a commodity to be exploited for our benefit. How much can they squeeze into 30 minutes? You know,
sure.
How much can I squeeze into an hour? You know, can I squeeze you into my schedule? Can I fit you in? We are prolific, sometimes over schedulers and sometimes, and then sometimes we just like let days slip by just doing nothing, like, you know, not leaving the house or whatever. Whereas I felt in France, for example, people enjoy their lunches more. They like sit down. It's a whole affair, you know.
Yeah.
They take like 2 hours for lunch.
Easy.
I'm in Buenos Aires.
We're prisoners. Yeah.
But let me ask, let me ask you, how do you think, what would you say on the subject of America and their treatment of time versus maybe some other places world?
This is a country that's a prisoner of time. Without a doubt, time controls us, not the other way around. The kind of the go of America, of the kind of American rhythm is definitely there. I'll just give you a very good example, something I would never do in the Middle East. Okay, when I have a meeting here with anyone, I get straight to business, right? I'm going to meet somebody. We more or less get to the heart of the matter pretty soon. That would be unheard of. That would be an affront to somebody in an Arab society or an Arab culture. I mean, if we could speak in those kind of broad terms in Middle Eastern societies, let's say. That's just one example that immediately comes to mind. It is, are you more important that you don't inquire into, you know, the health of, you know, my health or the health of the family before you get into, the business that you're gathered for. So on that element, yes, there's definitely a difference there. And as you said, the ability, to maybe have a long, lengthy, leisurely lunch. I mean, think about this country that built its up, built its reputation on fast food. I mean, what is the essence of fast food or the whole processed food that's causing now, pandemics of obesity? Was that it was maximizing your time, where you don't even have to get out of your car to have a meal. So you see how even that kind of maximization of time has literal physical effects on the human body, and let's say in an American context, that people would even buy a car that's electric, not for the sake of saving environments, but so they could use the carpool lane, for example. I could think of multiple examples of how time is commoditized. It becomes a commodity in this country. For that reason, I say it's not time is money, it's the other way around. In this country, our money is time. But this is the interesting thing. It's also, let's think about it in another sense, how we resist time in this country. Think about how many products are out there. How many procedures are there to reverse the effects of time? Botox culture began in the U.S. And by the way, Botox is having somebody who studied Iraq's chemical weapons. Botox is a chemical weapon. People don't realize it. It's a biological weapon, actually. Botulinum toxin was something that was weaponized to decapitate an enemy soldier. Oh, yeah. Botulinum toxin. You know it as Botox. Was originally designed as a biological weapon.
And what do you say to the... Continue.
I mean, you think about it. What is time? In our culture, it is that one variable that is so powerful because we have no control over it. No matter how much money you have.
And maybe we're control freaks. Is that what maybe you're alluding to? A little bit.
Yes. I mean, that's it. It's like, can you ask yourself, is there any more powerful force in our lives and time? That one thing that we are humble in the face of because of our inability to control it or stop it or reverse it. And you think in this country where we say anything is possible, I think it causes us a frustration where I think in other societies, you're more or less resigned to the progress of time or, you know, the thinking of time in a linear sense doesn't exist in a good number of societies. In our sense, particularly in the U.S., we think of time linearly.
What
in
sense?
A linear sense,
like
in that
teleological.
You know, we began. Yeah, teleological, in that, you know, what in our life did we achieve in this kind of nice vertical progression? And if the failure to meet that upward growth is a source of kind of insecurity, if we fail to, at this certain point in our lives, reach success as defined by our society, all a matter of time, you see.
Whereas in other societies?
Well, I mean, if you think about other societies that might see time as a circular process of, growth, And then regrowth, reinvention, I guess societies that see life in a circle rather than that vertical line.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking of, exactly. primarily. And now, of course, I'm talking about, again, a lot of pre-modern conceptions of pre-modern societies that didn't see, you know, life as a kind of this trajectory of upwards and onwards to inevitable progress, you see. That's why I think it's kind of we're a prison to that way of imagining time.
I think certainly it's one thing against which I have rioted, this notion that, well, rioted while simultaneously falling victim to it. I am American at heart. My individualism, I think, comes from, in some ways, America. It wasn't always well-received in Australia. They have this tall poppy syndrome.
I want you to think about that. Individualism is what? Don't tell me what to do with my time. You have no right to do that. I mean, think of that, when we're getting into kind of the American core of this. That's what it comes down to, I think.
Don't tell me what to... Yes, perhaps.
In the sense, you can't... You have no, yeah, exactly. Let me be free to choose what I do with this very limited, you know, material that I have, and it's the time on this earth.
I think that it's so baked into the cake that people aren't... a lot of people, anyway, don't have this discussion with themselves. They're not saying, don't tell me what to do with my time. It's more like, don't tell me how to mow my lawn or where my kids can, you know, don't scold my child for not riding a helmet on a bike or whatever. I think of the classic Karen example, very American.
Well, masking, yeah.
Or masking, sure. Masking.
That's, so, I mean, I still see that all related to kind of that individualism. It's up to me how much, you know, how I spend my life on this earth. And if I choose to wear a mask and if that's going to extend my health or not, that's ultimately my decision.
Yes.
I think that's, again, how I always reduce it back to the kind of temporal element, temporality.
I think people don't like resignation. They don't like giving up or acquiescing to anything, frankly, but certainly not to things that ultimately are out of their control. There's a short story by Dennis Lehane called Animal Rescue. Dennis Lehane, he wrote, I think he wrote Run River, and also Animal Rescue was turned into the Drop, which was a movie with Tom Hardy and James Gandolfini before he passed away. Anyway,
by the way, Gandolfini is in a film about my life, but we'll talk about that later. Go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt. But remind me.
That.
We'll talk about The Sopranos later. But go ahead, please.
There's this short story, Animal Rescue, and the last line, which became the movie The Drop, but the last lines of this movie, Animal Rescue, are sometimes you just can't control things. And I mm-hmm. think that this is a concept that's very foreign to a lot of Americans. I don't know. It's got America. Yeah, America is wonderfully diverse and rich and complex, but it's fascinating. Maybe there's this whole like resistance to government too. I think it's baked into our DNA as a nation of sort of don't tell me what to do.
But then again, you think, what does government take from us in terms of when they tax
everything,
us?
Everything, Ibrahim.
But also, what I mean, taxes are what? We use that time to produce this much wealth, and the government takes it, right?
Yes.
Then isn't that also
a
resistance?
Taking our time.
In other words, the government is extracting our time in this sense, yeah.
How would some guys...
How
would some guys drinking coffee in Damascus think about time, or would they not think about it at all? They just experience it differently.
I would say they experience it differently. Guys drinking in Damascus would be there for a very long time, first of all, taking their time. None of this business of kind of drinking espresso quickly and go on your way.
Right, no espresso. It's a nice coffee, or it's an espresso, they sip it.
Oh, no, it'll be in a little cup, but still they'll take their time and sit down, talk to the people around them. Now, keep in mind, Starbucks culture has taken root in the Middle East, and kind of this obsession with time has kind of infected Middle Eastern societies. But definitely, I would say there is still at least a resistance to this, the way that kind of time dictates your life, where you become the lord over time, not the other way around. And you know, I don't want to say this in kind of like this orientalist sense of these, you know, Middle Eastern societies. I'm just saying something that I observe about the rhythm of life is it is quite different. And it's something that I admire.
It's
there where they become, they are not subject to the dictates of that intense schedule that for the most part in the US we self-impose upon ourselves. This is what we got to realize. We're resistant to government, yet at the same time we will put this kind of prison of temporality upon us in terms of our lives and deadlines to meet and what do we do with our, you know, how do we become more productive and so on and so forth? It's very much, I think, a product of, you know, the modernity that, you know, defined this country, for better or worse.
Rhythm. Rhythm is an appropriate word here. And it's something I've been trying to unlearn in recent years, what I was so heavily conditioned into. I still value productivity very highly. I still have all kinds of metrics that I use. I keep track of what I'm doing. I keep track of my literal diet. I keep track of my media diet. I measure a lot of things, and I measure productivity with a certain calculated rubric. But as I've made more time for some of these little things in life, enjoying, you know, coffee or a glass of wine or going for a walk in the morning, stopping, literally stopping when it's very sunny outside and just feeling the sun come in.
The whole mindfulness, the whole ethos of mindfulness is to do that.
I think there is some of it's a bit cringy, but like, there is certainly something to the mindfulness, the wellness, all of this. That shit's important. That shit's very important. The reason I think, among others, I'm just thinking, saying this out loud now, that there's such a big wellness industry in the U.S. is because there fucking needs to be.
It's interesting when you notice how you used it in your everyday language. Let's think about this. When we say window of time, time out, time slipping away.
Yeah.
I mean, all in due time. These, the time of our lives.
Yeah.
You go out on a date. You don't even have to use the word time. But do you see how kind of temporality
on a
pervades?
Date. Yes, yes, yes. Let's make a date for.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Tuesday. Yeah, yeah.
I'm so glad you brought this up. I mean, your timeline, so on and so forth. You see, I don't think those words translate well in other languages. You see, I can't think of their equivalent in Arabic, for example. So maybe they're, and you know, of course, what was Einstein's ultimate reminder to all of us? Time is the ultimate illusion, right? If you think about that, I mean, here I'll just give you another example of different visions of temporality. There was, you know, upon the U.S. withdrawing from Afghanistan, there is this kind of apocryphal exchange where somebody in the Taliban told one of the Americans, I don't remember the exact contents, you guys have the watches, but we have the time. In other words, what do we have in Afghanistan to our advantage? This is our land. This is where we come from. You might have the watches, those fancy watches, but at the end of the day, we can wait you out. We will just wait you out. Time will be our weapon, you see. We will weaponize time. You will get tired and leave. And sure enough, exactly 20 years to the day, that's what we witnessed in 2021.
Hmm. Hmm. No, you're a smart guy.
Thank you. No, you know what's interesting is I would say, you know, the time system that we use is actually, I could say it's a Middle Eastern invention. It comes from Iraq, actually.
What, like water in a pot dissipating or something?
I said, no, I'll tell you that we don't really, we never think about it. Well, you know, the whole time system that governs us, who came up with it? In ancient Iraq, life was governed by units of 12. So that take 5 times 12, what do you have? 60 seconds. And then those, so we're talking about kind of, you know, ancient Babylonian, an ancient Iraqi legacy. 5 times 12 is 60 seconds. Then 60 seconds, you take that, you know, makes a minute. 60 minutes makes up an hour. And then what do you have? You take 12 hours in the day. Again, the 12 figure. Divided by 2, what do you have? You have 24 hours a day. And that's it. Our 24-hour day rhythm was a legacy from ancient Iraq. It's the, you know, in ancient Iraq where we get the 12 signs of the zodiac, so on and so forth. In other words, temporality was very much, we could say, this Middle Eastern legacy, so that the way we kept time was, you know, dictated on these units of 12. And then, sure enough, we became, you know, prisoners to that legacy, that system of little 60 seconds and 60 minutes and 12-hour days dictating, you know, the way we divide the time of our existence.
Yeah.
Just another anecdote, since we're talking about the legacy of Iraq in our present.
I used to race competitively. Ski race. I have double blacks tattooed on my arm, you know, like slalom and giant slalom. And for us, you
that's
know,
that's very interesting.
Yeah, I grew up racing. I love skiing. Skiing is, I don't like the cold. I don't like sort of overcast gray skies. But what the one exception to that is I get seasonal depression. But the one or seasonal affective disorder. The one exception to that is when I'm on the slopes. I fucking love skiing. Anyway, so I grew up racing, and for us, you know, on a slalom course, a second is, it's not, you know, for a normal person, a second is a second. For us, a second is the difference between like maybe 10, 11, 12, 15 places.
Sure.
And then you go to milliseconds. And that's where the real battle happens, is can I beat this guy by a millisecond?
Yeah.
There's this quote I've pulled up by Mark Levy, apparently. It seems like a French guy. I'll read it. Maybe a bit sappy, but I think you'll appreciate it, Ibrahim. If you want to know the value of 1 year, ask a student who has failed a course. Not one of your courses. You would never allow a student to fail.
I would not.
No. If you want to know the value of 1 month, ask a mother who gave birth to a premature baby. That would be me. If you want to know the value of 1 hour, ask the lovers who are waiting to meet. If you want to know the value of 1 minute, ask the person who just missed the bus. If you want to know the value of 1 second, ask the person who just escaped death in a car accident. If you want to know the value of 1/100th of a second, ask the athlete who won a silver medal in the Olympics. Now, the athlete who's won a silver medal in the Olympics, having lost by 1/100th of a second or less, and the student who has failed a course, have both lost something. And yet, I would gander that the athlete feels that they've lost more because they came closer, right? There's this expression from The Fast and Furious, one of the great American film franchises. I fucking love it. And that's not sarcastic. I love Fast and Furious. But there's an expression in the first movie, whether you lose by an inch or whether you win by an inch or a mile, winning is winning. But for the person who loses, I think it's worse to lose by an inch. It feels worse to lose by an inch than it does to lose by a mile, even though you did a pretty fucking good job. You know, like if you are out there training every day and doing what needs to be done and taking care of your stuff and building whatever project that you're working on, and it doesn't quite work out, but you almost get there and you lose, you know, you don't get funding for your art project, whatever. But you were really close. You were the runner up. You still did something great. You achieved something extraordinary, like you shoot for the stars, you land on the moon kind of thing. But it feels worse to lose by an inch. You know what I mean?
Oh, I'll tell you a recent example. I was at San Francisco Airport, and they had an exposition. And only in San Francisco can they do this, where they have like a mini museum in the airport terminal on the way Japan has influenced Western art, which is, a subject that fascinates me. I live by it. So, of course, on the way to the gate, I just got so sucked into this exposition that I missed my flight. By a minute, they closed the door a minute. Now, had I been so sucked into the exposition that I missed it by an hour, I would say, okay, that was an hour well spent. But the fact that they closed the door and they wouldn't open it up and they closed it just a minute ago, that's what really hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I missed my flight and I was stuck in San Francisco for that evening. Which wasn't bad because I got to enjoy that exposition. And then, you know, a lot of kind of, you know, Japanese influences are kind of in my life. And so that's what stopped me. And but yeah, because of that 1 minute, I missed it by a minute. Yeah. It's a brilliant poem where Levy's time is relative, basically. That's what he's arguing.
Just like our boy Alberto, what's opined? It reminds me, I had a guy on this podcast. He's a good friend of mine. He's a professional poker player, or he is a poker player. I don't know that he plays professionally anymore. Anyway, that episode is called An Infinite Game. And the reason it's called An Infinite Game is because Andy, the gentleman on the podcast, was talking about how life and poker are both infinite games. How, like, maybe you lose a hand, but or you lose a game, but you lose a hand, but your chips are still ultimately up. And we get so hung up on the small losses, right? The small defeats, like getting banned from getting, you know, cut out of this plane and having to take it, you know, be stuck in San Francisco for a night. We get so wound up about these small defeats that we pout about it rather than saying, okay, I'm here. Life is an infinite game. Maybe I lost the hand, but ultimately in the infinite game of life, the chips are still up. Or maybe they're down, but they are where they are. Life is an infinite game. There'll be another hand to play tomorrow. Or, you know, you play where you are, you know? And so you have to play things as they are. There's a book by Joan Didion called Play It As It Lays. I'm a little all over the place. There's a line from that book, actually. That's a fantastic fucking line. One of the best lines that I've ever heard. Let me look it up. Let me find it. We can cut the dead space.
It adds to the suspense. Okay. Maybe keep it in there. But speaking, there's a storm coming in, and this. Oh, go ahead.
No, sorry. There's a storm coming. Do you have to adjust? You have to go?
No. It's just that the the sun just went away. So I know what you're saying by kind of being affected. It makes a huge difference on me as well.
I hate it. They actually make these things called sad lamps, which are, it's sort of 1984-ish, but they're lamps that are supposed to mimic the sun.
Interesting.
You should get one. They're cheap. Yeah. They're, well, I don't know, cheap. But
daylight savings. I hate the fact that we mess with the cycle of time and
well, it's all arbitrary. Yeah. What is it? Someone's like, Mitch, you know, whether you wake up at 6 or you wake up at 5, did you get your work
exactly
done?
Exactly. Yeah. But when the times when the sun sets early, I'm just absolutely miserable. I can't wait for March 21st. I'll gladly give up that hour to have later sunsets.
Well, here I found the quote. All right, here we go. It's from Play It As It Lays. One thing in my defense, not that it matters. I know something Carter never knew, or Helene, or maybe you. I know what nothing means and keep on playing. I'm going to read that a second time. One thing in my defense, not that it matters. I know something Carter never knew, or Helene, or maybe you. I know what nothing means and keep on playing.
It's brilliant.
I think this is, when it's overanalyzed, we can let it sit with its own aesthetic beauty. But
yeah.
As far as play it as it lays, the infinite game, where the golf ball, that's an expression from golf, where the golf ball lands, you fucking play it as it lays, you know? Mm-hmm. You don't pout about the fact that you hit it where you hit it. You don't pout about the fact that it's not in the middle of the fairway. You, or at least for me, I've adopted a mentality where you have to take ownership of where you are and move forward with whatever's reduced set of circumstances that you have. And when you look at things like that, when you look at everything as an opportunity to explore something new, Ibrahim gets shut out of the flight. Wonderful opportunity to explore, you know, a city with many hills and beautiful landscapes in it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's kind of a philosophy that has kind of guided me. When misfortune comes, it's up to you to actively try to find some kind of silver lining in that misfortune. What happened was, it could be on a micro scale, one night stuck in San Francisco. Again, I was furious at that moment, but again, how bad was that? But then again, when I look at, what happened in my life in the aftermath of the plagiarism of my research, when I moved to Turkey, when I graduated from Oxford, my first academic position was in Turkey. And when I moved there, the way the media remembered this whole affair, they remembered me as not somebody who was plagiarized, but somebody who wrote the dossier because he intentionally wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein. I was remembered as the architect of the entire Iraq War. That's how I was remembered. It got bad to such a point where I had students protesting against me, to the point where I finally had to leave Turkey, and which I loved. To make a long story short, because again, when we were talking earlier about refugees and kind of the push factor, nobody wants to leave home. But I made the risk of moving to Madrid. Now you might say, okay, is that such a bad risk? It was for me. I knew nothing about Spain, knew nobody there, started work at a university that had just opened up that year and had zero students. But upon reflection, it was the greatest thing that could have ever happened to me. Now, if you asked me this in the year 2008, the year of the recession, where I was really worried this university in Madrid was going to, go under, I wouldn't have said that. But you're right. It's up to you to, either, just be patient for that silver lining to emerge, or up to you to actively make it a silver lining. There's two ways you could go about it.
Rather than stewing in power.
Yeah. No, easier said than done, though. I was, yes, but ultimately that guides me. And, the story I told you in class was about how my grandfather got tuberculosis and probably cursed his luck. And think of any of us who've been infected with COVID and probably felt the same. But were it not for tuberculosis, a series of events would have not have happened where he met my grandmother. I was talking to somebody who comes from Jordan, whose grandfather had diphtheria. But if her grandfather never contracted diphtheria, she would not be alive today. So again, you know, these disease and maladies might cause you to suffer. But in some cases, you know, we're all product of the kind of fortune that emerged out of misfortune, whether it's tuberculosis or diphtheria. And we complain so much about COVID, but God, you know, just even not even 100 years ago, it used to be so much worse. It's not until the 1970s we smallpox was eradicated for the most part. So, but I mean, there's just a couple of examples that came to mind.
I think all circumstances create opportunity. I mean, you know, some is easier said than done. If your house was fucking bombed out and your wife and your children
well, there you
died,
go. Exactly.
You're not going to be left a particularly happy camper.
It is, I mean, it is a luxury if we have that ability to transform misfortune into fortune or opportunity. But you're absolutely right. And when I hear other stories of, you know, the family you have in Iraq, I can't imagine what they've endured or how they could, you know, do this mental exercise. But somehow they still persevere.
Okay, Ibrahim, I want to, again, be respectful of your time. So wrapping up here and getting to the final questions. You're a wonderfully interesting guy. You have very eclectic interests. You have an extraordinary encyclopedia of knowledge cooking around in your throttling around in your cabeza. So why don't you tell us what some of your research interests are, some of the courses you teach, what makes you tick?
Oh, yeah, sure. So what makes me tick? It's a very good question. It is, as a professor, getting out of the ivory tower and reaching out and kind of, you know, engaging with people like you. It is to take my research and have it, you know, make a tangible difference. So what am I working on now in terms of projects, research agendas, looking at how climate change is affecting Iraq, how it affected Iraq in the past, how are climate fluctuations affecting Iraq in the future, in the present and the future? That's one element. Documenting the transformations that Iraq has endured over the last 20 years, but also, you know, also developing new courses beyond just the Middle East. So one course I'm developing now is a history of food, drugs, and drinks.
Oh, wow.
Which is
it's fascinating.
So I'm looking at anything from the, you know, the emergence. That's why I was talking about kind of processed foods earlier, the history of LSD, how kind of psychedelics have been part of pre-modern societies. Why do they get stigmatized in our modern societies? But let's bring it forward. I mean, when you consume psychedelics, what do? You lose track of time. It's quite interesting. In a society where always this time is about productivity, it's always go, go, go. And then you think about what are psychedelics. They're exactly that which
time gets totally
warped. Yeah, exactly. And it's quite interesting if we think is one of the reasons they're stigmatized so much. And kind of is for that reason. So that's one course I'm developing. Another course on the history of magic.
That's cool. That's really cool.
It's very cool. That is one of my favorite
courses. We
should
do a whole separate episode on that.
We should, definitely. But again, let's bring back magic to time. I mean, what is the ultimate magical power?
It's a sleight of hand.
Go back in time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, go back in time to be able to freeze time, to go forward in time. And I don't know if you're familiar with Harry Potter.
See.
So you think about the enchanted car that allowed Harry Potter and Ron to get to Hogwarts. It was a car that was able to fly, just for example. That was a time-saving mechanism. That was just the first example that came to my mind. Or even the act of conjuring, which isn't really magic. It's a different field. It is to do something in such a quick amount of time you don't even notice something has occurred in front of you. You've deceived the way your eyes perceive time, for example. But anyway, so yeah, I'm developing a class on history of magic, another one on history of animals.
What?
And I just, yeah, oh, you can't imagine. I had a very interesting lunch where we were talking about the history of elephants. I was talking about elephants as battle animals.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's an interesting thing when we're talking about elephants.
How do you get the departments to approve all this shit?
I'm working on it, but not at the California State University. Unfortunately, I having trouble at my university.
No, but you know what, Ibrahim? There's plenty of people who sell courses on the internet, and I'm not saying like you're obviously a professor. You hold a professorship at a university and teach all over the place. So I'm not. I know it might sound kind of lowbrow to you, but it reaches more people. Not everyone can afford to go to university. You should maybe put some of this on the internet for free. Look at the master classes, you know? The 10-minute videos, and then there's sequence, that kind of stuff. Exactly. I'd love to take a class in the history of elephants. That's awesome.
And it was amazing. And if you ever watched the Tolkien films. In one of the Tolkien films, there's a battle scene with these elephants. And that all had to do with when Tolkien was, you know, a British professor. He was a veteran of World War I. He fought in World War I for the British Army. He came back to Oxford. He was bored grading exams. He turned one exam over and started to write a sentence about a hobbit. And, you know, remember the British were in India at this time. That's where the battle elephant was pioneered. And if you ever see a scene or read about it, about these kind of battle elephants, this is where it comes from. It comes from the British experience of encountering the elephant in Indian society. I have an elephant right in front of me in this notebook. But that's just one of many how various animals give us diseases, how we give them back. And then I heard this tragic story just today of how an elephant in the U.S. was lynched.
What?
Literally hung.
Could you hang it? It's too fucking heavy.
You couldn't. They tried to shoot it. They tried to lynch it. It was awful.
No, I'm sorry. It's cruel. Like, that's sad.
It's cruel.
But how do you? No, Ibrahim, it's too heavy. How doesn't hang from a...
These guys were awful, sadistic, cruel, but I just never knew about this episode.
How do you hang it? From what?
Well, so go ahead. We're both going to have to go to Google and, you know, look at this episode of lynching an elephant. But also think during lockdown.
What the fuck?
Well, who was Tiger King? This, the series that captivated us during the pandemic was just another series of our in the history of animals.
True. Joe Exotic. Free Joe. Hashtag Free Joe.
Exactly.
But, you should be an influencer. You should make TikToks and reels and, you know, whatever. I mean, I don't know if you have any interest in that.
I would like to, because you also say I'm really all about getting this kind of history out there.
Or a YouTuber. I watch all the YouTube videos. That's cool. All right, continue. Please. What else is cooking? I mean, you give a pretty exhaustive... What are your... degrees
in sustainability. Sustainability is such a key kind of buzzword that we use in this day and age, but I could also come together and give you a history of how sustainability has been an element in, let's say, Middle Eastern societies for ages. In other words, these societies can teach us in a modern world about sustainability around the other way around. Yemen was one of the best places that you could, you know, give examples of kind of history of sustainability, but also that country in its civil war has done something very unstable, unsustainable, and that is kind of deplete its water aquifers for this narcotic, by the way. If you're talking about history of drugs, I mean, that whole country was more or less hooked and addicted on this very mild narcotic that only grows in the mountains of Yemen called khat. And, for the year I was there, that's your whole life revolved around chewing this ball that looks like matcha in your mouth. And then the other class
nicotine? It was like tobacco or what?
It's a little bit, it's a different, no, it's not like tobacco. It is, I would say it's a bit, it depends how you define it, or what kind of khat you have. And so QAT. It can do anything from slow your heart to suppress your appetite to relax you.
Is this the shit that the Thai taxi drivers are chewing? It's like beetle or like, you know what I'm talking about?
That's a different substance. No, this is can only grow in the mountains of Yemen and Ethiopia. It's specific to this area, so you cannot see Thai people.
What am I thinking of? The like beetle thing. You know what I'm?
I know those leaves.
Yeah, it's like a leaf.
And it's also consumed in India as well.
Mm.
Pond, they call it. Yeah, I know what it is. I do have to investigate. What is that?
Well, I like matcha. I like the taste of matcha. So maybe
it looks like matcha, but it's quite not. Different. I'm a big matcha fan. And then the other subject that I've it's really tragic. It's really hard for me to do, but I need to do is a history of gender-based violence. And this really came out of what ISIS did to my country and the women that they enslaved and the fact that the world forgot about these women. The Iraqi government definitely forgot about these women, that these women haven't been accepted back in their home countries. And, you know, this has been a story that's been occurring since time immemorial. You have, the first ancient Hammurabi's law code. We celebrate it as the first law code. But it was also the punishments inflicted on women throughout history is something that needs to be taught. So that's it. From the history of magic to the history of gender-based violence, these are the classes I'm working on at the moment.
Fascinating. Yeah. And what you hold a PhD and a master's degree as well, right? Or what?
Yeah. So my PhD from Oxford in history, and then I did my master's at Georgetown in politics.
And what was your thesis at Oxford?
Oh, at Oxford. So it was one of the first histories of the 1991 Gulf War based on documents left by the Iraqis in Kuwait.
Mitts on them?
Sorry?
How'd you get your hands on them? You went over there?
Oh, well, the Iraqis left them in Kuwait. That's a good question. And then eventually a good number of those documents were digitized by the U.S. military, and then they were made public. So you're right. It's a good question. How do you get that? It took a long time for them to get digitized. But by around the year 2000, they were available to the public, and I was just the first to, you know, gather every single one of those documents and say, let's try to write a history of the kind of Gulf War from the Iraqi perspective. And yeah, like I said, that's what got plagiarized. And finally, to bring it to The Sopranos and James Gandolfini.
Yeah, that's on my question list.
There's a film called In the Loop where James Gandolfini plays Colin Powell. Mm-hmm. And it's funny how they made from Colin Powell, they made him into James Gandolfini, I think just to avoid royalty. Yeah. And they made me into a woman. Actually, it's Anna Chomsky in the series Inventing Anna on Netflix.
Oh, I don't think her last name is Chomsky, but yeah. Yes.
Or Klumsky. Or I'm really embarrassed that I'm getting it wrong.
No,
she plays me in the film.
Oh, wow.
They made me into a woman.
Well, I mean.
As well, to avoid royalties, I think. They made me into Anna. Oh, no. Yeah, they reinvented me as Anna.
Anna Delvey.
What is her name?
Delvey,
yeah.
I think. Or maybe she had her fake name. I don't know what her real name was. Maybe.
The actress, I think her name, who plays the journalist.
Gotcha.
I think her name is Anna Chomsky herself. I could be wrong. I think I might be just mixing up names. No, her name is Anna Chlumsky. How ironic. Chlumsky. And she ended up doing a series called Inventing Anna. Okay. What are the odds?
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so this forgerer, I guess her real name was Anna. It was just a coincidence in this case.
I'm looking at pictures of James Gandolfini.
In the Loop is called, yeah.
Yeah, In the Loop, James Gandolfini dressed up like Colin Powell. Oh, wow.
He's one of the rotund American generals I've seen in history.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Anyway, Ibrahim, is there anything, there's a lot, you know, there's a lot here, but is there anything we didn't cover that you'd like to get to in this episode, or shall we save the rest for future conversations?
I'll be more than happy to do a future episode.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.